This story is called The Muscle Car. On Sundays, during the terrible days of the Great Depression, my parents used to take my brother and me for walks in and around Mödling, and to pass the time while we trotted along, one or the other of them would tell us stories about Uncle Gergi and a vehicle called the muscle car. I should point out here that both Gergi and my father, Felix Kreisler, supported their families by copying scores and parts for a music publisher. Our family was a little better off than Gergi's because Trudy, my mother, Schoenberg's daughter, Arnold Schoenberg's daughter, herself a musician, always pitched in to help my father with the work, whereas Tante Annie, Gergi's wife, was a good seamstress, but not musically inclined, and was unable to help Gergi. Yes, often in those hungry days, Gergi had to struggle just to make ends meet. Sometimes he worked 18 hours a day. He guzzled huge amounts of coffee and smoked incessantly in the process. If this and the fear of starvation was not enough, he would stick his feet into a bucket of cold water that he kept under his desk for that purpose. But even then, the poor man often fell asleep. Now for the story of Gergi and the muscle car. First, let me tell you how the story got started. One day in 1934, a strange little vehicle rolled into Mödling and came to halt in the town square. A young man and woman jumped out and began distributing circulars to a crowd that had quickly gathered. It turned out that their vehicle did not have a motor like other cars, but was propelled by pushing a pedal with one's feet, which caused the rear wheels to turn. To stop, one simply pedaled in the opposite direction, like a bicycle. Because only human energy was necessary to operate it, their energy to be precise, the couple called it a muscle car. According to their circular, the two of them had built the car by themselves, using only wood, except for the wheels, chains, and screws that held it all together, and painted it with clear lacquer. On the roof of the little car, they had placed a sign that read, "Von Hamburg nach Kairo im Muskelauto," from Hamburg to Cairo in the muscle car. A basket stood next to it with another sign asking for a small contribution to support the venture. They got hungry twice a day. And believe it or not, despite the fact that those were not the best of times, a goodly number of coins landed in it. Uncle Gergi was absolutely dazzled by the whole idea and couldn't stop talking about it. He too would build such a vehicle one day, he boasted, and he too would sally forth into the wide world. He and Tante Annie and little Susie too. And on the way, he would write a fascinating book about their adventures, full of wit and humor, that would go through many editions with millions of copies sold, and the three of them would have plenty of good things to eat and warm clothes, and would never have to worry about money again. Yes, Gergi was a dreamer. Over the next several months, Gergi tried to make good on his threat or promise and sketched out travel plans using the maps in an atlas. I believe he even looked around for parts and materials to go into the making of the muscle car. Or his muscle car. Their itinerary would take in Hungary, Romania, Turkey, and even India, he would tell one and all. Yes, just so long as the terrain was flat, as they would have to be towed over mountains, which could prove expensive, and put a serious dent in the little hoard of donations they collected. Well, there it ended, with the proverbial wolf always at the door in those dark days of the Great Depression, and Gergi always having to play catch-up ball. The plans for his great adventure and his own muscle car just never went any further. Or should I say rather that there the trip ended for Gergi and his family, but not for my brother and me. As I said earlier, every Sunday on our walks, our parents told us story after story about Gergi's muscle car in endless sequels. The first installments, as related by my mother, Trudy, obviously had to do with what the car looked like once Gergi, following the example of the young couple from Hamburg, put it together. The main point was that because of Gergi's large circumference, Gergi loved to eat, there was just enough room for him plus Tante Annie and Susie, skinny as they both were. Clothing and victuals were tucked away under their seat. Apparently, my folks had a tremendous confidence in Gergi's skill as a mechanic, for the car held together throughout all their travels in these stories and was hardly ever in need of repair. Such crises as occurred were almost always due to the problems that plagued them at home: lack of money and the tendency to splurge when things got a little better. And this led to many comical situations. To bring in some money, one time they went looking for treasure. On other occasions, Gergi and Annie helped peasants till a field, milk cows, or split wood. In towns, Gergi sometimes got work as a salesman, while Annie hired herself out as a seamstress or a cook in order to avoid waiting on tables, or worse yet, washing dishes in an inn. From time to time, for lack of money, they had to spend the night in their tiny vehicle, the three of them wrapped in a single blanket. Once in a while, circumstances were such that they were forced to go hungry, only to find heaps of the most wonderful things to eat at the nth hour, when they were on the brink of starvation, or sometimes they came upon a necklace to sell or to win a lottery. This, I might add here, illustrates my parents' perception of Gergi's haphazard way of earning a living back in the 1930s. And so, little by little, the stories had Gergi and Annie and Susie traveling through Hungary and Romania, and then Turkey, Arabia, and India, and finally Spain and Africa. It should be noted that in these stories, Spain, both in its appearance and customs, was still the land of Don Quixote. And while the inhabitants of Egypt were Arabs, complete with burnouses, camels, and lances, in secret, they still worshipped Isis. The Black Continent also ran true to form, with adventures galore among the Menschenfresser, cannibalistic savages with wild jungle creatures from which they always managed to escape by the skin of their teeth, or rather by the sweat of Gergi's brow pedaling away. Only once in a while did linguistic problems arise to vex my uncle in his muscle car travels. 9 times out of 10, a person would turn up who could speak German. In fact, quite often, they would encounter someone who had lived in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Sometimes Gergi had to trot out what he remembered of French from high school. Nous avons faim, mais pas d'argent. pouvons-nous vous payer demain? On other occasions, he was forced to venture into English, which he did with the aid of a phonetic dictionary.
Where is your chief? We want to sleep here.
And have you for us work? And then there were the times when a sign language had to be devised with the primary subjects of conversation, their immediate needs, and lack of funds, clearly spelled out with gestures and grimaces. Each time they left, Gergi, Annie, and Susie would always return again, like Don Quixote, to Mödling, as he returned to his village in Spain. And each time they arrived, they would solemnly declare that there was no place in the world as lovely or charming, but then promptly set off again with Gergi's feet churning away at the pedals. How ironical, then, that in 1938, everyone was to leave Austria for faraway places except Gergi and Annie and little Susie. My parents, the authors of those wonderful tall tales, and my brother and myself, their listeners, went to New York City. And eventually, we two boys to such far-flung places as Italy and New Guinea in the U.S. Army.